Welcome to How Did You Think of That? My name is Temple Grandin, Professor of Animal Science at Colorado State University.
And I'm Sherry Quinn. On this episode, we peek into the world of veterinary science and medicine with Dr. Tess Guy. Guy was influenced by Grandin's animal behavior books and research, and continues to utilize Grandin's teaching at the Grove Veterinary Clinic in Newport, Oregon, where she works as an associate veterinarian. Dr. Guy didn't take a typical path to veterinary medicine, if there is such one. Through our conversation, Grandin and Guy revealed how they pried open tricky doors to careers and opportunities, and how they overcame barriers to reach their goals and triumph, despite some difficult trials and tribulations. A note of caution. This episode contains a story about suicide. If you or someone you know is in emotional distress or suicidal crisis, please call the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988 or go to 988lifeline.org. Guy and Grandin first discussed the importance of focusing on people's strengths and avoiding labels.
I lived in Utah for about 17 years after undergrad, and worked at Utah State as a research chemist in environmental chemistry, and before that a veterinary technician, and decided at 35 to go back to school. And I went to vet school through Utah State and Washington State, and graduated a little over 2 years ago. And I've been working and just been really happy with it and the change. And so we've moved away from Utah. We now live in the Oregon coast. So my wife works at the Oregon Coast Aquarium.
And what kind of veterinary work are you doing now?
Mostly small animal. I'll do horse work on my own horses and some friends' horses, but mostly small animal.
And how do you like this compared to doing research chemistry?
I love it. Yeah, I like the variety and, you know, different problem solving skills than research and lab work. But I like the interaction with people and obviously pets, and just every day is different, which is nice. It's definitely
a problem I see with parents of autistic kids today, or kids that have any label, is that kids aren't learning enough skills.
Mm-hmm.
Getting so
mm-hmm.
overprotected. They're not learning work skills.
Mm-hmm.
Shopping, banking.
Yeah. I had a student I worked with, and I was a teacher's aide. I wasn't a teacher, but he was great mechanically and with his hands, and he loved, you know, motorcycles and wanted to you know, work as a mechanic. And his mom just was a teacher, and she just all she focused on was his math skills and didn't.
Well,
really,
and a kid that's going to be good at fixing motorcycles is going to have bad math skills.
Yeah.
And I've never have done algebra, but I found out there's this whole part of engineering. I call it the clever engineering department. And mm-hmm. I talk about it in my visual thinking book.
Oh.
These are the people working in the shop that are inventing mechanical devices and patenting them and selling them around the world.
Yeah.
And a lot of them have really bad math skills. Now, they can add, subtract, divide, multiply, you know, find the area of a circle, that kind of stuff. But when it comes to algebra and abstract math, they can't do it.
Yeah, I think it's important that we let everyone focus on their strengths and not put labels.
Well, there's certain, you know, arithmetic you have to learn how to do just so you can run a business. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, then I talked to one person who was working in a shop last year, and you know, they allowed him to substitute business math for algebra, in other words, what he would need to run his shop.
I thought it was interesting what you told me about how some of Temple's books have influenced you with your work, especially with animal behavior.
And Thinking in Pictures was one that I read and just absolutely was enthralled by. And then, you know, finally getting into vet school, and you know, we don't get a lot of behavior training at all. And in school, on my ICU overnight rotations in fourth year, would grab any of the behavior books that I could find on the, you know, on the shelves and start reading. And I just find that so interesting, because it's such a big part of interacting with any animal. And there's so much better ways to interact with an animal that's fearful and fear aggressive than just manhandling and stuff.
True.
I've had my own, you know, rescue animals and family animals that have just been traumatized for their whole life and just totally broken trust with humans in general, because they've just been grabbed and restrained, and things have been done, and it's really hard to get that back. So yeah, I really appreciate your books, and I've learned quite a bit from them. I love trying to look at a situation, a behavior situation where I have a fear aggressive, dog. I personally like Great Danes and Giant Breed dogs, so I'm the vet in the clinic that gravitates towards those, and walk into a room with a German Shepherd that just sounds like he wants to eat you, and just try and visualize what they're seeing and come up with a plan that de-escalates their fear and allows us to work with them. So I definitely do enjoy those.
How often do you get into a problem where the dog views that he has to protect his owner against you?
It's pretty common, and sometimes we'll try either, taking the dog away to a different area, which can be helpful depending on the area. Sometimes, our regular treatment area in the back, it's noisy and there's a lot of other, animals and stuff. So that can be triggering, but we'll take them into a different, quieter room. And if they're food motivated, we'll try and distract them that way. Sometimes I'll have them skip their breakfast meal, so they're hungrier and bring their high drive treats. A few dogs are more toy driven, so I'll have their owner bring their tug toy or their ball or something like that, and start playing with them, and then take them away for any treatments or anything that we need to do, blood draws, and that can help.
Well, and I've heard of situations where the dog was protecting its owner.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the situations where maybe that owner needs to be down the road.
Yeah, and some definitely do. They're like, hey, they do better, away from me because they're protective. I'll step out, the owner will step out of the room and come back, or we'll take the dog to a different room and come back. And then I've also had dogs that just react to coming in the building. So we've done exams and stuff out in the backyard so that they don't have to go in the building at all, and that definitely can keep them calmer than coming in the front and waiting in the lobby and coming into a room and waiting more. And it just increases their anxiety. So,
well, you can get fear memories that are kind of like a picture.
Yeah.
My book, Animals in Translation, about a horse that was terrified of black cowboy hats.
Mm.
Used by somebody wearing a black cowboy hat. White
mm-hmm.
cowboy hat, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
See, it was a picture, it was specific.
Yep.
And one of the questions comes up, should the vet wear the white coat? Depends upon how the animal perceives it.
Mm-hmm.
Perceived with, this person is going to grab me and do all kinds of terrible things, then you might not want to get rid of the white coat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's say you've done a lot of fear-free stuff, then you might want to keep the white coat because it's not associated with something bad.
We had an owner that her dog we couldn't handle at all, and she spent almost a year coming in weekly and working just on training, and we called them happy visits, basically just coming into her room. She had a half ball that she would teach her dog to place and stand on, and we just practiced touching and things, and eventually were able to do blood draws and stuff that we weren't able to do a year before because she took the time and we took the time to, I would hope, replace some of those fear memories.
Well, yeah, and the other thing is nail trims being a fight.
Mm-hmm,
I have a slide that I like to show at veterinary conferences of a lion cooperating with a nail trim meatballs,
mm-hmm.
and put his claws up on the this grating, and they would
uh-huh.
the nails.
Yeah.
And it was trained for that. And if encourage people to work with training puppies to tolerate helping their paw held, and if they don't pull
mm-hmm.
it away, they get a treat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then nail trims wouldn't be a fight. I think another problem we've got today is a lot of animals lead way too sheltered a life.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't getting exposed to enough stuff. It makes them afraid of everything. And this can be really a big problem.
How busy is your clinic?
Very busy. We're one of three clinics in the city, but especially the summer, we get a lot of tourist additional one-time patients and stuff, emergencies and things. So we've got three full-time doctors and then two that work part-time.
Would you say there is a shortage of veterinarians, or how is it looking, the landscape of veterinarians?
Yeah, definitely a shortage. I mean, basically everywhere we go, I've worked in Salt Lake, and then I've worked here on the Oregon coast, and we always need more help, especially not just veterinarians, but support staff, technicians. And, every time we feel like we're full staffed, something happens. But yeah, I feel like we could always use more.
Why did you decide to become a veterinarian.
I feel like I was born an animal lover, always gravitated toward animals more than people. And so growing up, that sort of was the dream. And then I got into undergrad and did sort of the pre-vet track. I went to school at UC San Diego and graduated with a degree in environmental chemistry because it was close enough to biochemistry, but I didn't have to compete with all the med students that wanted to get into med school there. So I finished school, and the plan was to apply immediately. I moved to Utah because it was affordable. My brother was going to school at Utah State, and I wanted a horse, so I knew that moving to Logan and Cache Valley was affordable, and I could do that and have that. And started waiting to try and get in at a clinic, and that's where I worked in special education for a couple of years and then got in as a vet tech. And by then it was close to 2007, 2008, and recession, and looking at going to vet school and getting out and getting paid $35,000, which is what I was making at Utah State. And it didn't really make sense financially, living on my own. So sort of put it on the back burner, but always loved it. And so by the time I was ready to go back to school in my mid-30s, it was just the dream that I'd always, wanted. So I had a couple of friends sort of encourage me to, that I wasn't too old to go back to school. And yeah, it's been great.
But I thought you worked in a chemistry lab for a while.
I did. Yeah. I was a vet tech for about a year and then decided I wanted security, I wanted insurance and all that stuff. So working at the university was a better option than working as a vet tech. So I got on there. I actually worked in molecular biology for 2 years at the veterinary diagnostic lab and then got the job over at the water research lab on the other side of the campus. So worked there for about 10 years in the water lab.
Because you had to get do a job to kind of put money on the table, you might say.
Yeah. So I was single and I'd bought in a house and, just wanted some stability, and I missed, working with animals, but it was more secure. So.
Can understand that. Lots of people, I get asked all the time how I got interested in the cattle industry, and I get exposed to it. I tell a lot of parents, kids have got to get exposed to things, and I think a lot of kids today aren't getting exposed to enough different things. And then mentoring, exposure, then mentoring. But if you're not exposed, how could you get interested?
Yeah, because you wouldn't know about it.
I think we need to be, like, especially with autistic people, looking a lot more at, okay, what kind of career could this person do? The visual thinkers like me, not the math minds, I'm not saying for all of us, but things like very high-end skilled trade is a really good place to be. Art's hard to make enough money in now. What I've found, what I've observed, is that art and mechanics go together. I know that sounds weird, and music and math go together. And there's a huge need for people like to fix elevators. Stuff so as I travel around, I'm seeing broken escalators everywhere that nobody's working on them. They're not getting worked on. That's not for everybody, but and one of the things I talk about in my talks is skill loss, where there's a bunch of stuff we don't make, like specialized food processing equipment. It's coming from Holland now. That didn't used to be the case.
Interesting. Definitely feel like there's areas that we're missing. And I know my brother is very artistically minded, and during COVID, when he was at home and not out, he picked up welding and started working on motorcycles and in the garage and stuff. And that, has been really interesting expansion of what he loves to do. So.
Maybe he needs to be fixing motorcycles. For some individuals, high-end skilled trade, and I'm not talking about laying floor tiles or something like that, but the real high-end skill stuff, and they're going to make good money. And the other thing is, artificial intelligence is not going to make fixing escalators or heating and air conditioning go away anytime soon. No,
Yeah,
that's the
that
kind of
was.
jobs that are going to be safe from artificial intelligence.
Is that in your field, coming into your field? Are you utilizing AI?
Not yet. I know that my boss is looking into some like record keeping AI type of, transcribing programs, because that definitely takes a lot of time in our day after a busy day of actually seeing patients, to sit down and have to write charts thoroughly and not, miss things. There's days that we're there till 8, 9 o'clock, writing charts. There's on one busy day, I was there till 11 at night, you know, and it doesn't happen every night. There's obviously nights we get out on time, but charting and record keeping takes a lot of time. So we're definitely, there's a couple AI programs that we're looking into. Obviously money and deciding on investing in a new program it takes time. So that's
and the other
definitely
thing is
something
AI
we're looking
is
into.
Advancing so quickly. One of the things that worries me about AI is it's so dependent on its training, and then its tendency, if it doesn't know the answer, just make stuff up.
What advice, Professor, would you give to young people who might be interested in a career in veterinary science?
I think getting in and trying as many different, you know, jobs, whether it be volunteering or you know, or working in different aspects of veterinary medicine, you know, there's so many different things. I mean, I've gravitated toward the most, you know, common that everyone thinks about, working with dogs and cats and, you know, small animal, but there's so many different facets. And, you know, I worked in research before, but so to me, I wanted more of the hands-on. So I gravitated back towards, you know, sort of the traditional work. But once you get into fourth year, you try so many different parts of veterinary medicine. And I just saw so many like niches that, you know, people weren't good at a certain thing, but they gravitated towards something else. And there's so many things that they could be doing. So I definitely think, you know, working at the veterinary diagnostic lab was really interesting to me. It sort of bridged the you know, medicine side with the research side, you know, for me. And that was really interesting. And pathology, you know, was something I liked, the figuring out, you know, all the questions of, here comes, you know, something, and we're trying to figure out, you know, what disease process they had, or, you know, and trying to find evidence of that. And so I think experiencing a lot of things and making sure that this is something that you truly want, because right now there's a lot of people that get into school and can't fit into the academic rigor that's set up. And it doesn't mean that they wouldn't be a great vet. It just means that academically, the way that they're requiring you to learn doesn't match with that person. And that's hard, because there's so many students that I saw. I mean, not so many, there's a couple in, you know, in class and stuff, that I thought that if they had been allowed to learn a different way, they would have been a great vet, but they failed
that's
out.
The problem. I was up in Quebec. They were telling me that the best bovine veterinarian they had for dairy cows almost flunked out of vet school and was terrible at math, but he could figure out things with the dairy cows. I recommend all students, like when they're in high school and college, to try on careers. I mean, shadow a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. Find out exactly what it involves. Because too often people go into a career and then they find out they hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to find out what you like, but also find out what you hate way before you make the commitment to, you know, do a long, expensive program and you find out you don't like it. You know, one person tries on the veterinarian and goes, I love this. Another person tries it on and says, oh, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. And I think it's also important not just to learn the hands-on, but the business side of things too, because that's, you know, definitely something I didn't really think about initially when getting into vet school. And, you know, I'm not a practice owner. I'm an, you know, associate vet, but, you know, a business side of it is what keeps things running. So learning that side of things, and I think is important to understand that you can't ignore that. You obviously have to stay solvent and be able to, you know, keep the business going, you know, so that you're able to continue doing the job and things.
That's right.
And I know at Washington State, we did have a business class, and I didn't take it, and I regret that. I feel like that would have been, you know, something very valuable, but trying to fit in all of my different interests, you know, I sort of pushed that one to the side because I had others. And I think that should be more of a core thing that I think everyone should learn, whether that be, you know, just in vet school, but I think in undergrad and college in general, I think it would be important. So,
yeah.
Did you have a mentor or mentors who maybe helped guide you or inspire you?
I did, definitely. I had, I have a veterinary, my personal veterinarian at the time before I applied to vet school. He was a big encourager to just sort of take that first step of like, it's scary, but take the step and apply and do, you know, do that. And he ended up, his name is Dr. Carl Hoops, and he ended up getting hired on at Utah State in the vet program. So he became a professor of mine too. So that was really fun. So he was definitely a mentor, and, you know, in school had a couple great professors that really, you know, were encouraging. One that I still talk to. You know, those are the ones that on the hard days in school, when you're like, this is so much information, I'm just not going to be able to keep up. You know, they sort of keep you going and remind you that, you know, past the struggle of learning, that you get to actually, you know, apply it and use it and, you know, show you the maybe not always fun, but the interesting sides of medicine and school. So absolutely. I'm really grateful for, you know, for people, for mentors. And then I would say family for sure. Couldn't do school and work and stuff without supportive family.
I'm wondering if you can speak to, there's more women now going into veterinary school versus men, except for maybe Utah. I've heard it's different in Utah. Is that what you are seeing? And do you have any ideas as to
why? There's more women in university, period, now. Well, we're seeing it because in our animal science department, a lot of students take animal science as the prerequisite for vet school. You know, we're like 70% women now. And what happens is about 65, 70% when they're freshmen want to become a veterinarian. Then by the junior year, they discover that's a lot of interesting careers you can do with a four-year degree. And that's a pattern that also shows up in other schools too, that they could do animal nutrition with a four-year degree or do some breeding or genetics or maybe meat safety or something. You know, these kind of things can be done with a four-year degree. You know, when I first started animal science, it was almost all men. Women didn't work cattle. That was a big barrier when I was starting out in the 70s in Arizona feed yards.
You must have been the only woman there, I'm guessing.
Well, there were women there, but they were secretaries in the office. They didn't go out in the yards and work with the cattle.
I bet that was really, really hard.
It wasn't easy.
Yeah.
And one of the things that helped me is I saw doors to opportunity. There's a scene in the HBO movie where I walk up to the editor of the magazine of our state farm magazine to get his card, because I knew if I wrote for that magazine, that would really help my career.
Mm-hmm.
That seeing a door to opportunity. And a lot of people don't do that. I've talked to a lot of parents of autistic kids, and they're so locked into the label. I said, well, you know, they don't think about getting their kid a job.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not learning their skills. And I said, well, who do you know that owns a shop? And then I push them and they go, oh, I know somebody's a little gift shop or some other thing, mechanic shop. I said, well, why don't you get your kid a job there? Make it happen. Back door, you know, seeing doors to opportunity. And I got a reputation for writing really accurate articles about cattle meetings. And I'd summarize the speeches accurately. And people appreciated that.
Because you're a visual thinker, was that harder to write?
I just took very good notes. I was an extremely good note taker. I don't remember things I hear very well. So, and I've learned how to write down really fast the stuff that was really important. Okay, so you have an hour-long speech on steamed flaked corn. That was one of them. I remember Bart Cardin from Arizona Feeds going, grain's the cheapest gain. That may not be true now, but this was 70s. And so that was the opener thing for his talk. And then he talked about different ways to process grain. And I wrote about it accurately. But what I'd learned to do was to take down notes of the really important highlights of the speech and just summarize what the speaker said. See, as I talked about, I'm seeing that talk. I'm also seeing the feed mill of his company.
Oh, interesting.
You see, that's how I'm bringing the information up.
Well, what do you think now it's the case that there are more women in veterinary medicine than men?
I think, you know, definitely those barriers have been broken. So I feel like it's more accepted and less judged for women to be entering the field.
Now, the hardest thing I had to deal with maybe on my third or fourth big project I designed was the ranch foreman told the owner that corral system did not work. And he was making sexual moves to me, and I rebuffed, I refused. And that was extremely difficult to deal with, and I almost quit. You see, and I talked to a lady pilot one time, Oh, it's really cool. She had me sit in the captain's seat because she wanted a picture of me sitting in the captain's seat. I said, how do you deal with the male pilots that get raunchy? She says, oh, I just say boys will be boys. But I got to thinking there's a difference there. That way airline crews are done is that pilot jerk is not her boss. When the day is over, she doesn't have to fly with him again. Mm-hmm. He's not evaluating her work.
Mm-hmm.
You see, where the situation I had with that foreman, that was a situation where the boss was evaluating my work, and that's much harder to deal with because then it was saying that your work was, you know, not standard. And I had no problem with guys kind of talking raunchy. I could do that back. But when it's the boss that's in a situation of evaluating your work, that's mm-hmm. a lot more difficult than some stupid jerk pilot that she had to fly with for one day of flying.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
she's darn sure she's not assigned with him again. You see, that's a very different situation because she just sort of, you know, I just had to learn to ignore it. But how mm-hmm. can you ignore it when it's the boss that's mm-hmm. writing your evaluations?
Yeah, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, that's the thing. And I tell a lot of people on the spectrum, when it comes to evaluations, you get good ones, you print them out, hard copy, you keep them at home, in paper. Things disappear online. So you have those to get another job.
And Tess, if you can talk about, I've heard that there's a lot more, I guess, mental health struggles in the veterinary world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, I think in any stressful, you know, job, but yeah, veterinary medicine, we're short staffed. We're in a lot of debt coming out of school.
That's the problem, the debt.
And you know, mental health and mental health, you know, taking care of your mental health is not taught in a lot of places. And I feel like that's definitely something that I think for anyone, but especially, you know, veterinary medicine, human medicine, you know, that it should be taught because you need to learn your own ways to deal with stress and to yep. de-escalate your, you know, your stress levels in a safe manner because, I've seen it firsthand. We lost an intern, a veterinary intern when I was in school to suicide.
Oh no.
So
well, they're known in the science magazines. I get Science and Nature in the back section. They're having a lot more articles about how to deal with stress at work and how to take care of yourself. I've had a lot of graduate students. I've used my book money and my speaking and money to put over 20 students through graduate school, either master's or PhDs in animal behavior related subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding what derails careers. And there seem to be two things that derail getting into good career. They just lose motivation. And the other issue is family issues and obligations that take up so much time they can't devote enough time to school. Those tend to be the things that derail careers. They know that they don't finish. And sometimes a student just won't tell you. I had one student that she was like an old flashlight. I have to have visual analogy, slowly losing its battery. Like she just run down. And I don't know what her problem was. She never talked to me.
Mm.
And then I have others where there's, I had a student who was an undergraduate in my class, and this was during COVID. I gave my phone number to all my students. And I talked to this one student for 45 minutes. And after 20 minutes, she was telling me that she had to take care of family members, and that used up all her weekends.
Mm.
And I said to her, you've got two really hard classes, statistics and organic chemistry. You're going to need to drop one of those classes and drop it now. I'm not going to tell you which one to drop, but one of those heavy duty classes has got to go. You simply don't have the time to do the work. And when you have no weekends at all to study.
I think that's important too for especially young kids to understand limitations that, you know, if you're pulled in too many different directions that you're not going to be successful. You have to accept that and adjust and maybe not take so many classes this semester.
Well,
and
what,
you know, if things open up next semester that, you know.
But I had to talk to her for 20 minutes before I really found out what the problem was. And that she wouldn't have enough time in the day to take two heavy duty lab classes
mm-hmm.
with so many weekend obligations.
Time management sounds like is another course that should be in these programs, time management.
Yeah, I definitely, it was my sophomore year in college, decided to cram all of my classes into like Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And I was playing basketball for university as well. And I was like, this is going to be great. I'm going to have 2 days where I don't have to go to class. But I ended up going to class from like 7 a.m. right up until basketball, and then, you know, getting home and like not even having time to eat lunch. And I ended up on academic probation because I just couldn't keep my grades up that semester. You know, came back spring semester and obviously adjusted things, definitely lightened my load, ended up having to go to summer school to sort of make up for that mistake.
What I've learned
junior and senior
is
year.
That I have to stay on top of students because very, very early in my career, I've had a student, wonderful student, had a paper published, just absolutely wonderful. And I hadn't been, you know, following up, you know, like, well, how'd you do in stats class? How did you do in your midterms? Now I do that. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the semester, she'd flunked all her courses. This is a long time ago. And she'd broken up with her fiance. Yeah. And I didn't even know she had a fiance. So now I've learned when it gets to be like time for the first quizzes, I want to go, you know, how's statistics class going? I have to find out how my students did on the midterms. This is when I first came here. I've been at CSU for 32 years, so this was very, very early in my career. I had to learn this.
And that's a wrap.
Thank you so much for listening.
And special thanks to veterinarian Dr. Tess Guy for speaking from the heart to us from the Oregon coast. How'd You Think of That is a production of the Utah STEM Action Center. Thanks to Jalene Bailey for production assistance.
This podcast is based upon work supported by the National Science Foundation under grant number 174-5674.